This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, today I am excited and very excited to have Don Schmidt and Tom Carey back with us to go deeper than ever before into the Roswell incident, which is the critical foundation of two things. One, the arrival of someone from somewhere else on planet Earth, and two, the cover-up of that which has continued until this day and is just now beginning to sort of shake loose, maybe. But a lot of problems. We'll be talking about their books. We'll be talking about Roswell, the ultimate cold case, and the new chronological pictorial. Guys, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you for asking us, Whitley. Nice to be with you.
Yes, Whitley, and thanks for having us back. Thank you.
Great. Well, these are two folks, as if you don't know, I mean, you know who these men are, of the finest researchers on this incident, or in fact, the best UFO researchers on the planet. These are highly skilled researchers. Highly skilled researchers, and how long have you guys been working in this field?
Oh my, combined?
No, not combined. We don't want to think each one separately.
Well, in my case, it would have been right out of college, working with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. And then after that, getting the attention of Dr. J. Allen Hynek himself and working with him personally from 1978 until his passing in 86. And then we proposed an independent investigation of Roswell in the fall of 88 with the Center for UFO Studies. And we made the first trip to New Mexico in February of 89, and then Tom joined us in a year later, 1990. So we're talking just on Roswell alone, 30 or 31 years,
and you're still at it. There's still, both of these books are so incredible. Tell us a little bit about the chronological pictorial.
Yes, Whitley. We've been as a team. Don and I teamed up in 1998. Now that was 1 year after the famous 50th anniversary hoopla that surrounded the case in 1997. Most of the investigators at that point figured, well, there was nothing else to learn about the case, but we wanted to continue a proactive, and I underline that word, proactive investigation of the case. So over the, Don and I have a combined 60 years of investigation into this one case. This is the only case we've investigated. And over those years, we've had a chance to interview many people, visit all of the sites surrounding the case, involved in the case, and we accumulated hundreds of photographs over the years. And we decided that we've been wanting to do a chronological timeline for a number of years, but we always had another book we were working on. But we said, let's do a chronological pictorial of the timeline from the time of the crash in July of 1947, all the way up to the present, which was this year. So that's what we did. There's over 400 photographic images. It's a coffee table book, 282 pages, I believe, somewhere around there. And over 400 pictures, plus the timeline, day by day, month by month, sometimes minute by minute, of what took place, starting with the crash, all the way up to the present. I'm sorry. So the people who have bought the book have views, words, fantastic, unbelievable, the best book I ever read. So we're very proud of this book because it brings what it does, Whitley, it brings the case to life. It brings the case to life. You can put faces to names. You can see what the crash site looked like. You can see where so-and-so lived, and everything is there, and it really puts the reader into the case.
Okay, great. It sounds fabulous, and I have seen only a PDF because this world we live in now is getting actual physical books from the publishers is not so easy. But it's a wonderful, wonderful experience because it's exactly what you say. It brings it to life. And so many of these faces, some of them very familiar to me because, of course, as my listeners know, I've been involved in this incident.
I think you're in there too, Woodley.
I know it. I haven't seen myself yet, I have to admit. But I'm not too surprised. Yeah, this has been a part of my life for a long time, and I've lived it. It started in 1987, though, for me, because
I was going to say 87, right?
Yeah, because but prior to that, I was not aware of my uncle or my father's involvement in anything like this, and I still don't know exactly what my father did, but he did something, I think. But my uncle told me a few things, and he introduced me to Art Exon, whom I then introduced to Stanton Friedman, and you guys, I believe, met him through Stanton, as I recall. Is that correct, or did he reach out to you? Because he was wanting to talk at that time.
As I recall, Whitley, it was mainly through you.
Was it directly through me? It could have been.
Yeah, it was directly through you because if anybody was rather negative on General Exon, it was Stan Friedman.
Yeah.
And I think it was partly out of jealousy because he never met with or spoke with. He attempted a number of phone conversations, but the general knew his angle, so to speak, and really didn't discuss the situation with him.
I see. That I did not know because the general never told me that. And he was a straight shooter. He told the truth. His cousin, Senator Exon, was really angry at him about what he did, too. And so was the Air Force. And he was, I think the last time you talked to him, he was already in the situation where he couldn't, he was afraid to even talk without his wife in the room. Tell us about
that is correct.
Tell us about some of your meetings with General Exon. I think they're quite fascinating.
Well, I'll tell you, the only time I met him, Whitley, was I believe it was in 2000 or 2001 in his retirement village in California. It's either
Riverside.
It was in.
I'm sorry.
Was it in Santa Barbara or Riverside?
It was Riverside.
Riverside. That's okay. Yes. We had lunch with him and his lovely wife, and quite frankly, I was disappointed because I felt he really, at that point, was not telling us anything that we didn't know. In fact, he wasn't even telling us the things that we already knew.
Well, but, he was under a lot of pressure by then.
Yes.
His phones were interviewed
by a couple of investigators with the General Accounting Office, under the directorship of the late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, who was doing his own inquiry into the Roswell incident. And the general had even made the comment, I suppose my house is being bugged as we speak. And according to the general, one of the investigators said, well, for getting involved with this, I would not be surprised.
Right. That happened, and I was to an extent blamed for this because he talked to me. My uncle introduced me to him, and they both talked to me fairly extensively. I'm not saying that extensively because my uncle was a zip your lip type. His entire career in intelligence work, I don't think anyone in this family knew much of anything about it. And I certainly didn't. And I was very surprised when he asked me to come down to Lackland,
retirement community where he was in retirement after he read communion, and he said to me, I have something to discuss with you. And he told me pretty much what he had experienced in the at Wright Field in the Air Materiel Command with General Exon. And interestingly enough, I asked him, well, you know, is this all secret? He said, yes, it is. And I said, well, can you, why are you telling me? Because I know, I grew up with official secrecy, and you don't talk to someone without a clearance if you don't do that. And he said, it's not illegal. And I've never known whether they were ordered to talk to me or not, or released to say what they said or not. I don't know. So, then I talked to General Exon, and it all started from there. Mm-hmm. But let's go on though. And
well, let me just quickly interject.
Okay, please do.
Because when the general first spoke with us over the phone, and then I met with him privately that one time in Riverside, and he pretty much verified everything we had discussed over the phone. And that's been the general story, as you know it, Whitley, and as we have published it through the years. Now, we think back to 1947, and then Lieutenant Colonel Arthur Exon is with T2, with Foreign Technology Division, but he's on the peripheral. He only hears what's going on. He only hears about all the material coming in. He only hears about their attempts to reverse engineer it and replicate and test it, and then their final conclusion that it was from space, it was not from here. And then he also heard about all the talk about the bodies coming in. And so he's already searching for answers because he's not in the loop, so to speak. So then he flies sometime thereafter, he flies over New Mexico, and he makes it a point to fly over not just one site, but two. The brief field and then the impact site where the bodies were recovered, which he verified to us. So he witnessed that himself. And then he goes on to become the base commander at Wright Patt in 64. And he would describe to us that even then there were entire areas of the base that were off limits to him. And he was the base commander. So is it any wonder that he was always very cautious about what he said? Because as long, and you talk about almost a lifetime that he tried to get answers, and he was always shut out. He was always told, don't ask.
Okay. let's go on to some of the other witnesses now, if you will. And I want to kind of circle back to the area that we have all wondered about always, which is the bodies and what they were and where they were taken. And we're going to take a little break for our Free Dreamlanders right now. Then we're going to get into that particular issue in a moment. We'll be right back.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's Revelations, Anne Streber's Mysterious Powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic eBooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. Plus, a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
Unknowncountry.com subscribers have
access to a vast treasury of information. Listen to what Dr. Robert Schock said. He's an expert on the past, and for that reason, he also knows a great deal about the future.
We are re-entering, as you say, a debris field, and when you have a debris field like this, it enters the solar system, it energizes the solar system as you have things going into the sun, even clouds of dust particles, for instance, it will energize the sun, it will destabilize the sun. This is what we saw at the end of the last ice age, in approximate terms, about 13,000 years ago.
You know, I'm updating this right now. This is the 19th of September, 2019, because this is happening. These asteroids and meteors are passing Earth close passbys all the time now. I'd say it's inevitable that this is going to happen. Robert Schock is right. We're going to get him back on Dreamland soon. And, you know, you will not find anyone else anywhere on the internet, any other podcast, doing this kind of research in this way with experts like Robert Schock. So subscribe today. Guess what? That's what you ought to do. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Do it now.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
The Roswell incident was an extremely complicated event and a big event. Now, I want to explore the exactly first Mac Brazel comes in to the Air Force to talk about the debris. Now, is there any evidence that the Air Force was aware of the presence of this before that?
That's a good question, Whitley. I don't think so. Since it was not the debris was not of their doing, they would not have been aware of it, and they were not aware of it prior to Sheriff Wilcox calling the airbase on the afternoon of July 6, 1947, after Brazel had talked to Frank Joyce, who was a radio announcer, and he just happened to call the sheriff's office at that time to see if there were any news items he could put on the radio. And so Wilcox gave the phone over to Brazel to talk to Joyce. And Joyce basically said, well, if what you're talking about came from the sky, then anything that comes from the sky is the province of the Air Force, so why don't you call the base? So the phone goes back to Wilcox, and he made the mistake of his life by calling the air base at that time, and that's when the Air Force first became aware of the crash.
And they naturally were terribly paranoid because the crash happened 30 miles from the only operational atomic bomber wing in the world. And the Russians had 4.5 million men ready to cross into Western Europe and were only being held back by fear of those atomic bombs. So,
and actually, the debris field that Brazel witnessed and then reported to the authorities is about 65 miles northwest of the base. The impact site, which became the much more sensitive, much more crucial location as far as the military was concerned, is about 35 miles north of town, and that's where the remains of the craft and the bodies were recovered. But when they were first alerted to the incident, it was one of the reasons that Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, immediately got on the horn, and he attempted to contact his own superior officer, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, at Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas. And Ramey was unavailable, so his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas DeBose, fielded that call, and he in turn contacted the Pentagon. So Washington was quickly informed of the situation. The point being that it wasn't a take charge situation. We know what's going on. We'll handle it. It was they were searching for answers, and what should we do about this?
Yeah, and yeah, because they at first they I'm sure they thought in Washington at least that this was some kind of a Russian spy craft. And now I heard something, and that I've never been able to verify, and that was that the bomber wing at that point in time was essentially a bluff. That there were no actual operational atomic weapons on the planes. And the fear was that the Russians had sent a device, a balloon of some kind, that would have radiation detection equipment on it to detect whether or not there were any bombs on that airbase. Now, did you hear anything about anything like that?
Whitley, there are all kinds of stories that I've heard like that. It was the big concern was that it was Russian. That was the big concern. But I think there was one story. Oh, Joseph Stalin was trying to scare us and all that sort of stuff. I myself don't put too much stock in that. But the big concern that it was Russian. They even brought in from El Paso, Texas, the some of the high-ranking paperclip Germans, Werner von Braun and Ernst Steinhoff. They brought to the crash site before they started removing things, mostly for the answer, because some of the wreckage had these symbols on them that they didn't know what they were, and they wanted to bring in someone who might be able to identify if it was Russian or not. And that's why the Germans were brought in, and they were able to say, no, this is not Russian. And this would be when the first officers and men from the 509th got out there to start removing the material. They brought the Germans in to before they started removing it to determine whether it was Russian or not. But there have been all kinds of stories, Whitley, about, it was a Russian, you mentioned a balloon or something. I don't know, maybe Don has something on that. I just don't pay attention to that.
Really talking about was the fear level would have been extremely high if the base, in fact, had no atomic bombs on it.
You are right about that, Whitley. You are correct about that. The racks, the bomb racks that they would have had in the bomb bays of the B-29s were not even kept there at the base. There was a system of breakdown that if they would go into any type of red alert, any emergency, that it still was not a case where if someone were able to infiltrate, come on to the base, they wouldn't be able to really recover anything. Nothing was there. The racks were kept at Wright Field in Dayton. A lot of the payload material, the uranium was up at Los Alamos. And the base itself, they had the B-29s, but they didn't have the weaponry. The bombs were not there. There were none really in our arsenal at that time. But I want to just touch back on something that a lot of people overlook. And just envisioning the rancher, Brazel, coming into town and reporting this. And the base commander, it's a holiday weekend. It's important enough that they alert the base commander. And he doesn't just send out a couple of low rank, a few grunts to go humor the rancher or check it out. He sends out his head of intelligence and his head of counterintelligence in the event it's something foreign. Because nobody's able to identify the material. And it's something that whenever anyone espouses an alternative explanation, they never consider what the eyewitnesses describe in regards to the wreckage. That this wreckage was nearly indestructible, that it had memory characteristics, that a sledgehammer couldn't even scratch it, that bullets couldn't penetrate it. They always neglect to mention the fact that this was far from any type of balloon or aircraft
right.
of any human or any conventional, you know, development.
Well, you know, one of the things that my uncle talked about was the various tests they performed at Wright, including firing bullets through it, the same thing that Jesse Marcel Sr. Said that they had attempted or made reference to anyway in that video that he left behind. And they performed many tests on it, apparently, and it was absolutely indestructible. Now, I heard years later from a man named Robert Sauerbacher. Are you mm-hmm. familiar with him?
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I heard.
He was at Research and Development with Kurt LeMay back at that time.
Right, and he was a metallurgist.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what happened. Stanton Friedman gave me his phone number, and I called him because I was very interested in the – this was before I had talked to my uncle. It was while I was still writing Communion. And I was – had I guess I seen his name in one of Stanton's book because that by that time I was researching quite heavily. I was probably about three-quarters or halfway through my book. And he told me about materials that they had analyzed. And he asked me to send him a detailed letter about everything that had happened to me, which I did. I sent it to him via UPS Overnight, which was new then. It was just starting.
Right.
And it was the first time I ever really laid out my whole story. And even though I was working on the book, this was the story, just the narrative from beginning to end. And I sent it to him, and a day later, I received a telephone call from the UPS man saying that he was dead, that he had mm-hmm. fallen off of his boat and drowned.
Mm-hmm, that is correct, yeah.
This was literally the day after we talked on the phone, and the package was never returned. I never saw it again.
My God. I was not aware of that.
No, I know. Not many people were. But he said something. I'm not certain he said this, but I think he said that they had discovered that after they began to use electron microscopes, scanning SEMs, scanning electron microscopes, that there was a mesh structure in the there were micro welds in this material, that it was not something that we could even come close to making.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard anything about that?
Like a precursor to nanotechnology.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Nanotechnology. We'll get into how much of this is actually bled out into the world in a few minutes, but do either of you have anything about this particular subject?
Yes, we talk about the memory metal, which there was much of it amongst the wreckage. But several of the witnesses described what we thought was the memory metal, but they said it was like a fabric or a cloth. And one that comes to mind is this Sally Tatalini, who was part of the Brazel family, and Bill Brazel had collected a number of pieces of the wreckage that he called scraps over the following 2 years after the crash, and he would bring a piece of it when he visited Sally Tatalini, and she says, "Oh my goodness, this is amazing! If they'd start making clothes out of this, it was it'd be terrific. We wouldn't have to iron it anymore." And so there were a few of the witnesses that talked about, we thought it was the memory metal. They were actually talking about something that was like a fabric. I don't know if it was part of the, what the aliens were wearing or what, but some of the wreckage that was found, that they were describing a sort of like a metallized fabric. And
I had heard that there were fabric partitions in it. that had embedded in the material, there were these faint purple florets that you could see inside the material.
Wow, that's news to me.
Well, as Tom and I have discussed, that the memory material would actually serve as the propulsion of the craft. That because it's malleable, because it's able to adjust and take shape and change shape and form as it maneuvers, that if the very cells, the molecules of the material, are integrated with some form of energy, that the very act of, you know, compressing and contracting and expelling energy would cause it to maneuver throughout the sky. So one of the reasons that we've had witnesses suggest there were no moving parts on it. But I do remember Sarbacher, he was mostly interested in the material.
Yes.
In that he felt that it would be the perfect material for the high rate of acceleration and then deacceleration of such a craft, that he felt that it would absorb a lot of that G-force just by its very nature. So it's all thinking along that same line, that the material, in having a memory, it has actually a brain of its own, that it reacts, you know, entirely to its immediate environment.
It's interesting that you say that. Can you tell us a little bit, expand on that a little bit? Let me ask you if you can do that.
Well, what I could contribute here, I'm not a chemist or a electrical engineer or something like that, but our associate in Florida, Anthony Bergaglia, has done the heavy lifting on trying to track what became of the physical wreckage. And he was able to identify a program that was loaned by Wright Patterson to Battelle Memorial Institute in
yep.
Columbus, Ohio, in 1948 to try to back engineer this memory metal. And he was able to obtain some of the progress reports and some of the experimentation that was part of this project. And so I just happened to read some of the write-ups of some of the experiments, which basically went over my head. I mean, stuff like that, when they get real technical with chemistry and that sort of thing, my eyes tend to glaze over. But what I did pick up from these articles that were written by the scientists was that when this memory metal, and that's what they were working with, they were actually given pieces of this memory metal, but when this memory metal was either morphing or demorphing, energy was created. I said, oh my goodness, the memory metal creates energy when it's you know, changing shape. So at that point, it sort of clicked that here was the motive force behind the craft, whatever it was that this memory metal, somehow they are able to capture this phenomenon of creation of energy and use it to their advantage to power these ships. And that's what I came away from with these experiments that they were doing.
Well, you know, that's terribly interesting, because the first UFO sighting in the United States over Mount Rainier, remember what
how Kenneth Arnold.
Excuse me?
Ken Arnold?
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly. Remember how Ken Arnold described the mm-hmm. thing as sort of sliding through the sky?
Skipping through the air like a saucer across the plane of water.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Well, that skipping, I think you might be describing that he might have been seeing that memory metal in operation.
What? Yes. I would even tend to concur. In fact, even by some of our now rumor technology, like pulse combustion. As people have been filming, videotaping dumbbell contrails. So it's an external combustion where a pulsation, that is, it pulsates, it propels the craft, the aircraft, faster and faster and faster. And that may be the case as far as with the memory material, that as it flexes, it propels the craft faster and faster, left, right, you know, it slows it down, whatever it needs to.
Right. Free Dreamlanders, I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is all for me. It is that you're going to do everything they ask you to in these commercials. And that's probably also bad news, but not for you because you're going to love it. We'll be right back. How curious are you? How much do you really want to know about the world you live in? There are, for example, very real conspiracies. We're talking about one of them today. And this is a place where if it's real, we're going to talk about it, but not if it's not real. So there's no confusion here. If we're talking conspiracy on Dreamland and on unknowncountry.com, it's because we can prove it, just like we can prove that the Roswell incident has been covered up. We can prove these things. We can prove that the abduction phenomena is in some way very real. We can prove that there are unusual materials in this world because some of them are right here in my possession. So, this is an unusual place. It's a unique place. And above all, it is a great place to explore. Exploring the unknowncountry.com archive is a really extraordinary experience. It's a place where you can regain what we are losing, which is a lost sense of wonder and a willingness and to explore the unknown. We live in a terribly difficult world right now. This place is an oasis of wonder. Join unknowncountry.com today.
War Day is one of Whitley Strieber's most powerful books. Join him and his co-author Jim Konietka as they travel across the United States devastated by limited nuclear war. This acclaimed novel was originally published in the 1980s, but now that North Korea has said that they can hit the U.S. with nukes, it's more timely than ever. Don't miss this informative, exciting, and convincing testament to the power of the human spirit in challenging times like our own. Get the ebook for $3.99. Go to Strieber.com for this and all of Whitley's great books.
We're talking to Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. Their website, www.roswellinvestigator.com. The books, Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case, and Roswell, The Chronological Pictorial, amazing book. It will bring this to life for you unlike anything you have ever read. And, you know, why do we need to even talk about Roswell at this point? We all know the Air Force lied, case closed, but there's so much more. Like the references to the Battelle Memorial Institute are very important. Those documents that we were just talking about are absolutely extraordinary, extraordinary importance, because right now, there are people working very hard to expose this enormous amount of research that has gone into these materials over the past 75 years that has been hidden from the public. Now, I want to circle back to that, but I've been promising, and I've been a bad boy, and some of my listeners will be furious at me. I promised before we left the air the first time to talk about the bodies. Now, I want to circle back and do that now, especially because when I say something like that, I usually do it. And we got so sidetracked in so much other fascinating stuff, I didn't do it. Now, let me ask you if General Exon told you anything about the bodies at all.
That's a good question, Whitley. I know he spoke quite lucidly about the wreckage, but he did have... that's a good question. You know, my mind is a blank on that.
If I might,
it's one of those senior moments you were speaking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah. Folks, you didn't hear me speaking about the senior moment because I didn't have a senior moment that was high level enough to not cause me not to turn off the recorder. But yeah, I did have a senior moment. I forgot Jesse Marcel's name. So, you know, now we're all confessing here. So, okay. Okay. So he never talked to you about the bodies. What do you know about them?
But he did talk about the body.
Oh, he did?
Yes, yes. In the earlier interviews, he mentioned that the talk at Wright Field was about bodies also arriving on a separate flight from the wreckage that came in earlier. So the talk was quite prevalent at first, and then it died down to a whisper. But then it quickly got to the point, don't even ask, don't even bring it up. And it was one of the reasons that when he later would fly over the site in hearing about the separate site where the bodies were recovered, he confirmed to us that he witnessed both locations. They both looked as though a full-scale operation had transpired at both sites, heavy tire tracks, heavy equipment. Still, you could see all the disruption in the landscape from his aerial viewpoint from his plane. So he was able to confirm multiple sites, and the talk at the base back in 47 was of the bodies coming in as well.
But there was no detail. There was no detail. It's just the mention of the bodies. We have, in our case closed book, we are putting together a legal brief that we would submit to a court if we were to go to court against, the Air Force. And we have a number of witnesses, firsthand witnesses to the bodies. And one that comes to mind early on was Major Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal at the base back in 1947. And on his deathbed, he mentioned, this was, I guess, 1992, thereabouts, his granddaughter, or daughter, one of the two, brought in a copy of one of Don and Kevin Randall's books. And she held it up to him and she said, "What about this, granddad?" And his response was, "Oh, the creatures." So he didn't go beyond that, but other than to him, the case meant the creatures. And we had a number of other witnesses that talked about the bodies. And when you had earlier, Whitley, asked about the bodies, I was, and my mind went blank on it, I was confusing Arthur Exxon with the fellow from Cincinnati who had contacts at Dayton, Ohio, on the base. He had medical contacts that talked about the autopsy that was carried out on the base of some of the Roswell aliens. And Leo Stringfield.
Len Stringfield, yeah. What did he say?
Well, what he would do is he would submit a little summary of what he thought the bodies looked like, and then his medical contact would, I was going to say email, they didn't have email back then, but his contact there would write back to Len, "You're right about this, you're wrong about this," and by the end of the correspondence, he had a sketch of what the Roswell aliens looked like, and passed the test from the medical person who was at the autopsy. And so in his status updates, he wrote a series of monographs about Roswell, about crashed UFOs, of which Roswell was part of it. And he would give a complete description, as he knew it, of the aliens based on what the medical person or persons agreed on. So that was That's what I was thinking of when you had to ask the question about Arthur Exxon, when he had whether he talked about the bodies or not. But we have a number of witnesses, two firsthand witnesses to the bodies, and that's in our book, Roswell, the ultimate cold case, that we would submit to a court of law in a legal brief filed against the Air Force. So I don't know if you want us to go into different witnesses.
Sure.
But we name them all in the brief.
Yeah, let's do it. That sounds absolutely fascinating.
Well, certainly Arthur Exxon was one. The other one that comes to mind early on was a fellow, Sergeant Melvin Brown. He was a cook in K Squadron. But he had a top secret clearance. He was not a youngster. He was at that time, I guess he was in his late 20s. But on his deathbed, he had moved to England, married an English woman, and on his deathbed, according to his family, he was talking about nothing other than Roswell. That it was all true, that he had a bank account that was $10,000 was put in his name in a local Roswell bank. For his silence, because he had been out at the crash site. They grabbed him because he was a trustee. They trusted him. And he went out in an ambulance to pick up a couple of the bodies, maybe two or three, from one of the crash sites, and drive it back to the medical facility at the base. And just before they left the crash site, they said, "Now, whatever you do, don't you look under that tarp that covered the bodies. Now, don't you look under that." Well, guess what? The first thing he's going to do when you drive away is he looked under the tarp, and he saw at least two of the bodies, little fellas, 3.5-4 feet tall, large heads, and it haunted him the rest of his life. And on his deathbed, he was talking about nothing but Roswell and all of the things that he knew, and plus the $10,000 bank account that had been placed in his name in a Roswell bank, which ultimately they never found. So those are two witnesses that come to my mind. There are others. Maybe Don has a couple favorites.
Well, we even had the account number, and so representing the family, you know, we went through all types of records, bank records, banks that no longer existed, with the hope of verifying the account number. But we had heard that from a number of other sources that they relied on a number of extreme measures in silencing the witnesses with the military. You know, typically just a matter of, enforcing an order. You know, you will never say another word about this. But they felt, especially with the low ranking, the privates, the corporal, ranks, that they had to sweeten the deal a little bit. So they would threaten them with Leavenworth, or they would be paid off to some degree. So we had heard of that. So we thought at least we would make the effort. But one of the more intriguing things about Melvin Brown, and Tom described the incident as he did, but on his deathbed, and we went back and I rewatched the testimony from his wife, Ada, and she really didn't want to discuss it. Most information we got from his one daughter, Beverly Bean, and the point was that his wife is describing how they had said their goodbyes, and she starts to wipe away a tear. And then she says, he then takes me by the hand, and he says, "Dear, I need you to know that I've always been faithful to you. I've always been loyal to you." And then he goes on to tell her all about Roswell. And the point being, he equated his faithfulness to her to what happened back in 1947. And that's the human element in dealing with this. And I'm just surprised how many colleagues in the field don't even understand that a deathbed testimony is admissible in a court of law. It's accepted as physical evidence.
Yet they don't want to understand.
No, they still argue, well, it's just anecdotal. It's just hearsay. No,
well, you know, here's the thing about that word anecdotal that drives me nuts. It means an isolated statement.
Precisely.
Something that is, I saw a dinosaur cross the highway. That is anecdotal. But if 150 witnesses come forward, it's not anecdotal anymore.
Precisely.
So, free Dreamlanders, now this is not anecdotal either. Listen up.
Ever wonder what the close encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision. Not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
When Plato's ancestor Solon received the story of Atlantis from this Egyptian priest, the Egyptian priest said to him, "Many and manifold are the destructions of mankind. You have know of but one, but you Greeks are like children. There are many, many destructions of mankind by all various types of means."
That's an excerpt from a show with Rand Flemath, who wrote the original book about crustal shift that is based on the theories of Charles Hapgood. There are three Dreamlands with Rand over the years. That one's from 2015. He goes all the way back to 2004, and they are totally relevant and totally fascinating right now. All you have to do to locate those shows is go to our search engine on unknowncountry.com and input the words Flemath, F-L-E-M-A-T-H, his last name, and all of the shows will pop up. And then, if you want to listen to these incredible programs, literally available nowhere else on earth, as far as I know, you can subscribe to unknowncountry.com for $4.95 a month or $39.50 a year. And when you do, you get a literal wealth of enjoyment from this website, including the full length Dreamland every week, every new Dreamland that comes up. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to the site and click on the subscribe tab. Get started. Now subscribers can also listen through any app that accepts subscription-based podcasts. One that we use is the Castro app, and it works great. You can have Dreamland pushed to your app every week. Subscriber now, just as you can, as a free Dreamlander. We're talking to Tom Carey and Don Schmidt about their books, Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case, and Roswell, The Chronological Pictorial. Their website is roswellinvestigator.com. And let's just roll on here. These witnesses, there are so, how many total really reliable witnesses do you have at this point?
Well, we have over 600 that have a little piece of the story. Now, Whitley, that doesn't mean that they know everything. They just know their little piece of the story. And we have up to 600 or more witnesses like that, first and second hand. They're not all first hand. In fact, maybe all of the first handers are gone now, but even some of the children are gone now.
Yeah.
But upwards of 600, and they all have a little piece of the story, which we were able, our job was to, it was like a jigsaw puzzle, put all the pieces together into a framework that makes sense. And that's what we've done over our 30 years of investigation of this case. And so some are better than others, but nevertheless, each one has its little piece in a framework that we have put together. And, and we knew we had it right when later on the witnesses that we were getting, their testimony fit within the framework that we had established. So, like I said, some are better than others, they know more than others, but each one has a little piece of that puzzle. And
let me ask you this about, you mentioned the children of the direct witnesses. Have you heard anything about abductions and close encounters among those children?
No, I can't
wow.
say that.
No. You know, just speaking for myself, I'm so focused on the Roswell case. Very few of them had stories like that. And unfortunately, Whitley, when they started talking about abductions, I sort of tuned out.
Okay, I understand why, too. The reason I ask is that I am in touch with a fair number of people whose families have been touched by this in one way or another,
well,
obviously.
Of course.
And
absolutely.
One of the things I've noticed, is true in my case certainly, is if your family had a connection to this, in some cases it was like the Air Force, some pilots who had shot at the visitors, or in my case, it's connection with the Roswell incident. They end up in your damn lap.
Mm-hmm.
The kids do. I mean, the lap of the kids, which happened to me, because it was all happened in 1947. And by 1953, 54, they were in my life. And that didn't happen to my cousins, I don't think, who their father would be the direct witness. But I also don't know what my own father did. I only know this, that Colonel Guy Hicks, who was the base commander in the Mantell incident,
That's correct. That is right. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Was cashiered, and he lived a block away from us for some unknown reason. And across the street, a couple of houses down from us, was an FBI agent who my father was very friendly with. And there was another fellow who was apparently an Air Force intelligence officer living next door to him. Now, what is that all about? I don't know. You talk about tight-lipped. My father was not the deathbed confession type at all, let alone during his life. So I have no idea. Maybe he didn't know a thing about any of it. But why was it like that? What was Guy Hicks doing around the corner from me?
That generation.
What?
That was also that generation.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
had all been thoroughly schooled into, you know, the very idea that if you spoke out of turn, you could jeopardize the national security of the country.
Right, that's right. And that's why my uncle and my dad were so tight-lipped. And my dad was so tight-lipped, I'm not sure he was involved. But
let's use another example, and I'll use two quickly. We talked about Jess Marcel, the intel officer back in 47, and when he went public in 1978, and he was only talking about wreckage as though he was testing the waters. He was only talking about material not made on this earth. He was so bold as to say it was not made on this earth. But the only publication that touches the story is the National Enquirer. Everybody else is quickly dismissing his testimony, and then the ridicule factor, you know, goes into high gear, and he regrets speaking out. Does anyone believe he's going to start talking about bodies or anything beyond that at that stage? No. It's all intended to keep you encapsulated, to keep you, you know, under their control on a tight leash, so to speak. So it might be one of the reasons that even the family members, they only go so far in their discussions with us, because Tom and I have always made every effort to speak with the spouses, to speak with the children, especially now with all the firsthand gone. Now we're left to speak with nothing but the families, with hopes that maybe they secured a deathbed. They got some additional information that we can plug in. That's the wonderful thing when we talk about even anecdotal testimony, the idea that the second hand often corroborates the first hand. And as a result, both become even, you know, almost, you know, jointly, you know, important in that regard. But quickly, we had a story of a metallurgist.
We don't need to be quick. We've got another half hour, so.
Okay, but I just, because I'm taking up more time.
No, go right ahead. Let's air it out.
We had a metallurgist in Alexandria, just outside of D.C., and we were trying to locate him. And then we hear a source at Fox News who confirmed to another radio DJ that Roswell was all true. That it did happen, that he heard this from someone else who happened to be very highly, as far as high up at the Pentagon in the military at this time. Well, Tom and I finally determined who that source at Fox News was. And then we discovered who also worked at Fox News, who is a full bird colonel, who happened to live on the same street as that metallurgist, was Colonel Oliver North.
You know.
So you see how, and we've often been criticized. Well, why do you guys look under every stone? Why do you check out every lead? Why do you follow up on every piece of information? Because it's only going to take one to blow this wide open. We can be wrong 100 times, but if we're right once, that's all it's going to take. And that's why we continue. We've made mistakes. Yeah, we've gone down wrong paths, wrong roads at times. But if we don't, who will? We have to.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me.
And, you know, and the other thing is that the subject of UFOs, Whitley, is still a taboo subject. It's becoming less of a taboo subject with the recent developments. But it's still, especially if you have a job that is fairly high level, or if you're in the spotlight and you need your credibility is your hallmark. You don't want your name in the same paragraph as the term UFO or Roswell or anything like that. But and Don knows this. We spoke about, just to emphasize this, we spoke about earlier about Major Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal at the base at the time of the incident. And we were able to talk to him. And early on, very early in the investigation, I think it was Kevin Randall spoke to him over the telephone, and Easley's answer to all of Kevin's questions was, I can't tell you, I'm sworn. I'm sworn to secrecy, I can't tell you. And I know myself, if I heard that, I would say, oh, well, that's the end of the interview. But Kevin, to his credit, he asked, well, Colonel Easley, can you at least tell us whether we're going down the right path or not? And Easley says, well, what path would that be? And Kevin says, well, we think it was a crash of a UFO. And there's a long pause. And Easley says, well, let me put it this way. You're not going down the wrong path. And that at the time was something big because, our investigation continued on with that knowledge. But in 1947, there was another major whose name I won't mention, but Don knows who it was, who was did almost the same job as Major Easley. Only this major was in charge of the really secret security guarding the so-called silver plates, the B-29s that would carry atomic bombs in case of war to drop on the enemy. And this particular major, we never could find him and any of his family, but recently we did. And the major, of course, is long dead, but we've located a daughter. All of his family is basically gone, but he has a daughter. And we located her. And so the question was, now how do we, and she has a very high profile job where she lives. And so we approached her first by email, not mentioning Roswell, just that we are historians trying to put together a history of so-and-so, and we understood that her father was in the Army Air Corps. She never responded. So we made a phone call to her voicemail, basically saying the same thing, and to call us back. Never called back. So the conclusion is, she knows why we're calling, and they don't want, especially if you're in a profile position, you don't want your name associated with any of this, whether it be UFOs or Roswell. So the taboo is still out there, and we were lucky that we got 600 people to basically break the taboo and talk to us. And that's been a, you know, besides the age of the case, you know, they used to have a show called Cold Case Files, you know,
right.
But they always had somebody that was willing to spill their guts, as they say. But we never had anybody like that. It was always trying to find somebody and get them to talk. And that we got 600 on the record, to me, that's an achievement. And
600 people. Listen,
yeah.
We have come to the end of the free part of the show, and which is unfortunate for our free Dreamlanders. And if you are a free Dreamlander, did you know that you can now listen to the subscriber version of the show on an app, on the Castro app, and any podcast app that accepts password protected podcasts, you can listen right on an app. So it's easier than ever to listen to Dreamland. And that'll be soon true of all of our other shows on unknowncountry.com, New Observations and The Unseen. So do stay with us. And if you're not a subscriber, maybe now is the time. We have been talking to Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. Their website is roswellinvestigator.com. The books, Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case. This will take you beyond where you are now, no matter how deeply you have gone into this, because we're talking to two people who've talked to 600 witnesses. I mean, you can't get better than that. And then Roswell, The Chronological Pictorial, which is a wow of a book. It opens this up. It's an uncanny experience to read. That's all I can say, because it comes to life in a completely new way. Free Dreamlanders, as always, thank you so much for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.